So, there's something I wanted to take up that's just been on my mind. It's a question that a friend of mine actually asked, Rabbi Avi Harm. I saw him over Passover. And it's actually within the topic we've been discussing the past month or so about God's justice and Kohelet. His question was regarding the servitude. If you have, wait a minute, if you want to get a hold of a Chumash. So if you want to get, you'll need Genesis and Exodus. So if you can, I'll wait a minute so you can get a hold of it, and then I'll give you the exact verses of what he was talking about. So let me just give you a minute if you want to go get a chumash. I'll hold on. Yes.
While people are getting those, you sent us a couple of references, one of which was the letter to the about astrology from Maimonides.
Right.
Is the copy that you sent us, is that what's out on Masora?
Yes.
Because I found what I think is a significant transcription error, and I just wanted to bring it to your attention.
Yeah, what is that?
When you get part way down, where do we go here? Where it quotes, about halfway down, there's a bolded section that says, "And now my masters know, and know my masters, it is one of the roots of the religion of Moses, our teacher," and so forth.
Can we just pull it
right
up? Let me go. I'll bring it up on my screen here. Just past the bolded, okay. I see it.
Right above that, it says, "Hence the sages maintain there is no death without sin and no affliction with transgression."
It should be without, you mean?
Right.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Let's see what it is. So just above "know my masters," there's two "know my masters."
Shabbos 55a.
It cites Shabbos 55a in the actual text of the article?
Yes.
How does the paragraph start?
That paragraph, which is a long one, are all three of these sects of the philosophers.
Okay. Got it. Okay, I'll take care of it. Thanks.
Okay, yep.
Okay, so let me give you the question. Very simple question. It turned into quite a study and enjoyable, too, I'd say. The question was, again, Rabbi Hari had this question. If you take a look in Exodus, chapter 12, verse 40. It says that the encampment of the Jews, the Israelites, that they dwelled in Egypt was 430 years. And all the commentators comment, and they say this is not so. And Sforno and Ibn Ezra clearly state that the 430 years from when they left had to be from the day that Abraham was taken out of Ur Kasdim. which is a reference to the furnace that he was saved from when he was thrown into the furnace in that the town. So if you date back 430 years, Ibn Ezra and Sforno, they come up with the same exact date. So I think it's clear historically that has to be what 430 years was. So the problem is, how can the Torah say that the encampment of the Jews, that they dwelled in Egypt, was 430 years? It just wasn't so. It was actually 210 years, as the rabbis say. So the Torah seems to be making a very difficult statement to swallow. All right, that's the question. All right, everybody's clear?
Yeah.
Really should say that the length of time from Abraham leaving Ur Kasdim until the Exodus was 430 years. That's what you should say. You shouldn't say that the encampment of the Israelites in Egypt was 430. You should say 210. But not only that, the next verse, 1241, repeats the date, which for some reason, it says, and it was at the end of 430 years. And it was in that exact day that God took out went out all God's hosts from the land of Egypt. So there's something very important to be stressed about that on top of the question. Okay, now let's turn back. Let's just keep that reference. Turn back now to Genesis 15. And we'll just go through that. It's a short chapter. Let's just read through it, and you'll see while we're reading this too. All right, so let me know when you have Genesis 15:1. We'll start right from the beginning.
Yep.
Okay. So let's just read through it. It was after these matters that the word of God came to Avram, because that was his name before God changed his name. His original name was Avram. That was Abraham's original name. So the word of God came to Avram in a vision, saying, "Do not fear, Avram. I am your shield. I'm a shield to you. Your reward is great." And this is because he just conquered the kings. He had killed people to save his nephew Lot. And so the commentators say that there was a concern that Abraham had about that, and God said, "No, what you did was justified, and you've not lost any reward that is due you." Okay? And then, since God brings up the matter of reward, so Avram responds to God in the vision, and he says, "God, my governor, what will you give me? And I am barren, I have no children. And the son of Ben Mesek Basi, who did Mesek Eliezer? Eliezer, how does he translate Ben Mesek? Damascus?
Demasi in my copy.
All right, so it's a location. And then the person from Mesek, of my household, Eliezer, he's, all I have is him, basically, saying. I mean, the Ben Mesek, the only possible inheritor is going to be this person, Eliezer, who is, again, you can ask a question, so what's, he was a great person, he was intelligent, God helped him out in terms of finding Rebecca for Isaac, so he was on a level. Then the Rashi even goes so far to say that, the Torah repeats over the whole story with Eliezer going to the well and looking for the one who's going to not just give him water, but proactively ask, "Can I also water your camels?" And it gives up a whole detail. And then when he finally goes to, and he sees Rebecca is the one that fits this, and she responds that way, and he arrives at her father, Bethuel's house, and Laban, her brother, the Torah repeats the entire story over again. So the Torah asks the question, what is so important about the words of Eliezer, a servant of Abraham? And the Torah spends so much real estate, and not just citing the story once, but repeating it, and in reference to the many commands that are like what they call the fundamentals of the Torah, they're only repeated very briefly. They're only stated briefly in the Torah. So why is so much more real estate given to the words of Eliezer? Just the words, the common words, how he dealt with his dealings, as opposed to the actual mitzvos of the Torah. You think that's skewed you know, improperly. So Rashi explains, as the rabbis say, that more beloved are the common mundane words of the servants of the patriarchs than the Torah of the great-grandchildren of the patriarchs. More beloved is just the mundane speech of the patriarch's servants. That's more beloved to God than the Torah of his great-grandchildren. So you see, it just pronounces how what that basically means. It's a very nice idea there, is that why is there more treasure to God? And again, it's pitting up just the mundane words of the servants, and it's comparing that to the Torah of the offspring of Abraham. His very seed is being compared to just a servant from Damascus, and the Torah is being compared to just mundane speech. So I believe the idea is that, because I don't want to get into this too much, I want to stay focused on our issue over here about the 430, but I believe the issue, the answer is that the servants of Abraham really represent Abraham. And it's trying to show you that Abraham and the patriarchs were so great because they arrived at an attachment to God and levels of prophecy on their own without any type of system, coercion, whatever. It was all internally developed. I mean, he really represented the capacity of a human being to attain such levels without anything more than just seven Noahide laws. And you see, God didn't give the Torah for 2,500 years. It wasn't until so much unfolded. There's so many corruptions in the Canaanites and the Egyptians that so many laws of the Torah are to combat those corruptions. But initially, the Talmud says that God gave Adam only one or three commands. Noah had seven. And Mila, circumcision was added to Abraham. So very few laws. So that's what I believe, that even the words, the mundane speech of the servants is much more elevated, much more beloved to God, because this represents the man who reached perfection of his own, as opposed to the grandchildren who had to have the Torah given to them. That is something which, of course, it perfects us, and that's a great thing. So it just shows you that's why the Torah goes out of its way to repeat the words of Eliezer, to show you how the human being can, with pretty much just a handful of commands, he can reach the highest levels. All right. Again, there was rare, very rare individuals, but it does show. It does show that this is a real perfection. Okay. Let's get back to our question. So again, the question is, you had the 430 years that it says that the Jews were in Egypt, and this 430 years, it doesn't seem to be accurate according to the greatest rabbis. Again, Sforno and Ibn Ezra are saying that the Jews didn't encamp in Egypt for 430 years. It was only 210. If you want to calculate 430 years as now being a date when they left Egypt. So 430 years earlier is when Abraham left Ur Kasdim. So clearly, the Jews were not in Egypt for 430 years. So the problem is how the Torah can say that. Okay. So let's go back now. We're in Genesis 15. So God's now giving a vision. This is predating. This is where God first announces to Abraham that about the bondage. And there's a number of questions I'll bring up, and then we'll see if we can address them. So he gives a vision to Abraham, and he says not to worry about the fact that you just took over, you killed these people to save your nephew Lot. Your reward is great. So Abraham responds, well, what type of reward is there? I have no children. And he says further on, and this is in 15:3, that he says, behold, you haven't given me any seed, I have no child, and the son of my household is going to inherit me, meaning Eliezer is going to be the one. So what's wrong with that? Look how great Eliezer was. Okay? So now God responds to Abraham. And behold, the word of God said to him, this one, Eliezer, is not going to inherit you. Rather, one who comes out of your own loins, meaning your own seed, is going to inherit you. that comes an interesting thing. In verse 5, it says, and this is in a vision. So Abram is not conscious. This is taking place in a vision. And it says that God took him outside, and he said, behold the heavens, and count the stars. If you're able to count them, this will be the number of your seed. So not only does God tell Abraham that he assuages his concerns about who's going to inherit him, and he says, no, it's not going to be Eliezer. It's not going to be this person from Damascus, however great he is. It's going to be your own child. And not only that, he tells them that your children will be as numerous as the stars of the heavens. And the next verse says, Vehem in Majum, that Abraham believed in God. God said this. That's it. That's the truth. And then the verse ends by saying, and God considered it to Abraham an act of like chariot, tzedakah, righteousness. What does it mean? It means that his belief was a proper thing that he did to his soul. A person could do charity to others. He could also do charity to himself. He can do an act of righteousness to himself. And the way a person does righteousness to himself is by having the correct notions. And when God tells you something and you accept it as a truth, that's acting in accordance. So that's you doing a righteousness to your soul. You're living properly. Okay, so far so good?
Yep.
Everything's clear. Okay. And, okay, let's go further. Okay, so we're now in 15:7. Now comes an interesting thing. It's still in the vision. God tells to Abraham, and he said to him, He said to him, I am God who took you out of the Ur Kasdim, the fiery furnace that you were thrown into in Kasdim, to give this land as an inheritance. So you'd think that God would identify himself when he first starts speaking. But it's now midway through this vision. Now all of a sudden God says, this is the God, this is the one who, this is, you know, I'm the God who did that, I rendered that miracle for you. Interesting. Just take note. Now look what Abraham does. He says, Abraham says to God, with what shall I know that my seed will inherit this, will inherit the land? So it's interesting. I mean, when God told Abraham that your seed is going to be as numerous, that you will have children, plus they'll be as numerous as the stars, so Abraham accepts that. No questions asked. But when God says that they're going to inherit this land, meaning the first part was that he's going to have children, and they will be numerous. That he accepts. But when God says they will inherit this land, now all of a sudden, Abraham says, what merit are they going to? Why doesn't he just believe this again? All right? Question. So what's God's response to Abraham's question? How do I know that with what shall it be known that my children will inherit this land? So God tells him to take a number of animals, and he's going to they're going to make a treaty. So he took all these animals, he split them, and he put one half facing the other half of the animal. And then it says a bird came down, that shows a vulture, some sort of bird, a bird of prey came down upon these parts. Ibn Ezra, I believe, says that at this part he was awake. God told him that this is how you will know that your children will inherit the land. Take these animals and divide them. So then Abraham wakes up, he gets the animals, he divides them. And he chases away some bird, some significance there, that comes down on them. Then it says he went back into a vision in verse 12. And it was that the sun was about to come. This here, I believe that's supposed to, it's about to rise. I only say that because in the vision, God's taking him outside to count the stars, and that can only be done at night. So I just believe that's consistent with what time of the day it was. Okay. So now it says that the sun was about to rise, and a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and there was a great fear, and chashecha gedola, chashecha means darkness usually, or fear, or here it means fear. And now God says to Abram, and here's the verse. You should certainly know that your seed will be a stranger in a land not to them, and they will be subjugated and they'll be afflicted 400 years. and also the nation that forces your children's servitude, I will judge them. Interesting. He says also the nation. What's the also? But afterwards, the Jews will come out with the great riches. Okay. All right, and ends up by saying that there was a treaty that got created, that he's going to give the land to his seed. So you see again, we have this count, but this is where it was promised. This is, I'm just going back to the source, because this is where it was promised. So you have just the broad questions. I mean, primarily you have that date, my friend Rabbi Har had asked. You have 430, it says they were in Egypt, but really they weren't. How could you say that? No. You have a number of other, and a lot of the questions are primary. And again, this is all touching on God's justice. And that's what we've been discussing in Qoheles. So if they're going to be enslaved, what was the question you would ask? And what, you could also tell me your own questions after we've read this now, if you want to take a moment, just digest what we've read, and tell me what's on your mind.
One of my first questions might be, why are you going to enslave them?
Good. And if you bring justice into that question, how would you reformulate the question?
What have they done that they deserve to be enslaved?
Exactly. Because God is purely just. There's nothing which evades God's knowledge, and there's nothing which evades his capability. That's why we say he's omniscient, all-knowing, and omnipotent. He's all-powerful. So where's the justice in enslaving them? He's telling Abraham this. And I would ask also, God knew this, but the days of Adam, the days of Noah, days of Shem and Eber, why didn't he tell them about this enslavement? Why is it only Abraham? So I would just add that. Okay, what other questions do you have?
Rabbi, what does it mean that the iniquity of the Amorite shall not be full until four generations?
That means until God could bring the Jews into the land, it has to be just on both sides. It has to be just for the Jews, but it also has to be just for the Amorite that they deserve to be kicked out of the land. But their sin that deserves their eviction won't become ripe until that generation. So God has explained to Abraham why it'll take that long, because God has to be just to all people.
Why is it that Abraham asked the question, whereby shall I know I'm to inherit it? I'm not clear from the English what whereby means, but it sounds like he's saying, how am I going to know this is going to happen? Which seems odd given that God just said it.
Well, not that he's asking how does he know. He knows that it's going to happen. God says that they're going to be given the land as an inheritance. But now Abraham is asking on the inheritance part, right? So God's response is, meaning to say, Abraham is asking what merit, by what merit will they inherit it? So we can answer one of the questions. When God makes a statement that's not dependent upon people's actions, meaning that Abraham will have a biological child, and they will be numerous, that depends on God. So that, Abraham had no question. God says he's going to do something. It's solely dependent upon him. He said he's going to do it. So then I have no question. But when something depends upon inheriting, there it would seem to be a question of, well, what merit? So there he asks, but what merit will my children, my offspring, deserve to get the land? Because Abraham understands about justice. I mean, he said by the destruction of, let's see if that was before or after this. Where was the destruction of Sodom?
Chapter 19.
What chapter?
19.
So it's after this. Okay. But you still see, even though it's afterwards, you see when God says he's going to destroy Sodom, so Abraham says emphatically, he doesn't question, he says, the judge of the whole earth won't do justice, meaning Abraham had a firm idea of the Creator being just. So if he's going to say over here that his children will inherit the land, so now that depends on the people. That's why he asked the question. By what merit will they inherit it? So what's God's response? Take these animals and divide them. So, of course, you'll ask the question. What's the question?
What's dividing those animals have to do with any of this?
Yeah, exactly. What does the fact that Abraham divides these animals have to do with... And Abraham seems to be satisfied with that, because he doesn't ask him any further. He asks, by what merit will the Jews get this land, inherit it? God says, we'll take these animals and divide them. So he does it, and that's it. And he's satisfied that that'll be it. It's very cryptic, to say the least. All right?
And as you pointed out, the verse about the birds kind of cries out for why is that verse there?
Yeah, exactly. Well, what's the significance of that?
I guess... In 10, it says he cut them, but he didn't cut up the birds.
Right, it says clearly he didn't cut the birds. I don't have an answer to that. I'm still, there's a lot of detail here. The more I was spending time on this, the more things, jump up at you. But I'm going to try and see if we could approach what the main issues are and see if other things fall into place. If we try to, really see what the most bothersome and most primary issues are. And maybe these things might fall into place too.
And just as an aside, my version has a couple of answers to that question.
Okay. Because let's hold off. Let's hold off on that though.
Really hold the neighbor. I'm sorry.
You want to hold off? Or you want to take that now?
Oh, I can wait. No problem.
Okay, let's hold off on that. Let's just get the. But I would like to just note that I do want to hear what your version has to say on that. Okay, so we have a number of questions. We have this prediction that God gives about the Jews being in servitude. The number doesn't seem to work out, the 430. It's not 430 in Egypt, so how come it says that they were in encampment? I mean, it's such a clear statement. And that the encampment of the Jews in Egypt was 430 years. It just wasn't. Okay, so there has to be something very important that's pointed to. Number two, like you said, Doug, there has to be justice, so what sin demanded that the Jews be in bondage in Egypt? Right? God doesn't afflict people unless there is some sort of a sin. And of course you have to ask that since God works measure for measure, and here's another primary point, how is this correcting anything? Whatever the sin is, and maybe the sin... Once we know what it is, we'll understand the bondage. But how does servitude correct the problem that require the servitude? Okay, we'll have to answer that. That's a primary question. All right. And when it says that God tells Abraham that, and also the nation that subjugates the Jews, I will judge. I saw the commentaries. I'm not sure if Sforno Ibn Ezra, but means to say that just, I think Ramban, Nachmanides, and Ibn Ezra, or Sforno, they both say that when God says to Abraham, and also the nation, meaning they're going to be servitudes for 400 years, and also the nation that subjugates them, I will judge, also means that just like I'm judging the Jews for their sin, I'll also judge the nation that enslaves them. So that's what the also means. Meaning God has indicated to Abraham with that word also, that just like the Jews are being enslaved and it's a judgment, it's due to their sin, I'm also going to judge the other nation that enslaves them. Okay, that's important to know. So the verse itself testifies to the fact that there's some corruption in the Jewish nation that required the servitude. All right, and of course we ask, how does the splitting of the animals do anything? How does that answer Abraham's question? But what merit will my offspring inherit the land? So God says, split these animals. And then Abraham seems to be satisfied because he doesn't ask anything further. Okay. Now, let's just understand something. That both we said, both Sforno and Ibn Ezra, and it has to be it's an empirical, historical fact, that if they both came to that conclusion, that the date that the Jews left Egypt was 430 years after what event? After Abraham was taken out of Ur-Kasdan. Now, if that's the case, how do both Sforno and Ibn Ezra understand the verse in Exodus, right? And that's 1240, that says, and the encampment or the dwelling of the Israelites that they dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. So how could they make sense out of that Torah statement if they're saying clearly that the 430 years was not the Jews in Egypt, but from the date that Abraham left Ur-Kasdan? All right, that's a powerful, that is the question, the most powerful question. But they're going to have to make sense out of that verse. Both Ibn Ezra and Sforno are going to have to make sense out of this verse. It can't be both. It can't be that Abraham left 430 years ago from Ur-Kasdan, and that the Jews also dwelt in Egypt for 430 years. It's impossible. Because at the time of Abraham, there were no Israelites yet. He did not yet have a child. All right, you see the power of the question, right? Okay. Now, this one. And of course, you know, we'll have to, it would seem to be, it is going to have to be a very cryptic type of a statement, that verse, 1240. And we'll have to understand why. Why is God cloaking that? Why doesn't God say that it was 210 years, but that something happened by the date of Abraham? And this is why I'm calling it 430 years. So it's a very cryptic type of a thing, and we'll have to answer that. Why is that approach being used? Many times in the Torah, you have a very clear statement. It gives you the years of Abraham, the years of his sons. I mean, it tells you exactly, these are the years of their lives, and it works out perfectly. Here it doesn't. So if it's a roundabout or a cryptic approach, I'm just saying that there must be a need for that type of an approach. All right, you understand my question?
Do.
Was that yes?
Up on the positive. Yes.
Okay, what'd you have to say?
Are you looking for possibilities yet?
Not yet. I want to hit you with all the questions until it's like a knockout punch, and you can't get up off the floor. This is what my goal is right now. And again, anybody online, too, I see Mike, Ryan, Z. If you have questions, you can type them on screen. Okay, Ryan, how's the audio? You said it was good before. It's still going good? Just give me an okay on screen. All right. There's also the question of why a treaty God made. You see that there was a whole vision. At the end of the vision, there was a treaty. God made a treaty. He's giving the land. Okay. Why a treaty? Why Eliezer was unfit, we asked. We asked, why did God have to take... What was that?
Did we ask about the great darkness? I mean, why has he experienced this dread and this great darkness fall upon him?
Yes, that's a very good question. Although that one I do not have an answer to, so I don't want to keep you hoping that will... I mean, maybe in the time I will. Okay, Ryan, thanks a lot for the confirmation on screen. All right. Yeah, I noticed that. I mean, it's going out of its way to tell us this. I hope we can get those. I mean, that's part of the structure, actually, of the prophecy, which to me is more of a difficult thing, but we'll see. We asked why he had to visually be shown the stars. Why can't God just tell him? You know, however prophecy works, it's not audible because it's not awake, but mentally he could just communicate, you know, the concept of what the words mean, numerous. No, it's a vision. He shows him, he takes him outside, and shows him stars. Instead of just saying, your children will be as numerous as the stars, he actually takes him outside and shows them the stars. All right? Interesting. And we asked, why did God wait midstream in the vision to identify himself as the one who took Abraham out of Ur Kasdim? Why didn't he say it at the beginning of the vision? Isn't that the best time to identify who's speaking? All right. And what was significant about Ur Kasdim? Also another major question. We asked how did the servitude correct the problem was another main question. And one thing also to note, one final thing is that, this is my last, my points, last of my questions, is that the exit rite from Egypt was the killing of the lamb. The Jews had to kill the lamb. Then they were worthy of the Exodus. Okay, Jim, it sounded like you had a question? No? Okay. Doug, go ahead. You said you had you wanted to start commenting, so let's start with you.
Well, I'm looking at 1240, and it says that the nation of the children of Israel during which they dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. So clearly, physically, that's not accurate. Therefore, the term dwelled in Egypt must mean something different than physical habitation.
Good.
And I'm guessing that it refers to something about their state, the state that they were in. Not geographically, but state of mind or state of relationship to Hashem or something along that line.
All right. Go ahead. You're just making an entry. You're just making an opening, you mean?
Yeah, that's just my start.
Okay, good. That's a very good opening. Meaning, if it can't be the 430, it can't be an account of the physical years. So what else is there besides the physical years? So you're saying it had to be some sort of a psychological or mental, because only... A person only lives in two worlds. He lives physically, he moves about, he eats, he has friends, he has a physical existence on earth, his waking state, but also he's got his internal life. Right, so that's what you're saying. It has to be something referring to the internal life. And then we'll have to understand why it's actually described in this way, as if it's really a physical dwelling in Egypt. All right, so very good opening. Everybody sees where Doug is going with that, right?
Yep.
Okay.
I could add, and I don't know if it'll shed light on it, this is from the Stone Edition of the Chumash, but it says that at that time, this would be the covenant between the parts. God foretold to Abraham that his offspring would endure 400 years, during which there would be exile, persecution, and servitude, but not necessarily all of them at the same time.
Right.
And they go on to say those 400 years began with the birth of Isaac. Thus, the Exodus was perfectly calibrated to conform to the prophecy to Abraham, for Isaac was born on the 15th of Nisan, and exactly 400 years later, precisely at the deadline, at the end of the prescribed time, the Jews were liberated.
Right.
So there must have been something about the state. I mean, if right at the... Am I right that, factually that Isaac was born at the same time as the covenant between the parts?
He was born at year 400. If you go back 400 years... So this was about that time, right? So it could be that's why it says 400 here, but it says 430 in Exodus. So from the time of Isaac's birth, the commentators say that's exactly 400 years later that the Jews left Egypt.
So if that's true,
that's Rashi.
He is okay.
Ed?
If he's the one then that's taking on the mantle of Abraham, so to speak, then it seems like it's suggesting that there's something unique about the state of the Jewish people starting from the moment of Isaac to the point where they were liberated that was not the case when it was just Abraham.
Well, this is what he's being told. So at this point, it'll be 400 years left. But when God recounts at the time of the Exodus in 1240 in Exodus, right? There, God recounts and he uses the number 430 twice. That means 430 is significant. Because that's really what was considered the quote-unquote dwelling of the Jews in Egypt. It was a whole 430, not just 400. So it's not Isaac's birth, but it's from the date that Abraham was taken out of Ur Kasdim.
Kasdim was 30 years before this. Though.
That's right. Kasdim was 30 years before he had Isaac with Sarah.
And Ur Kasdim was where he had initially dwelt with his father Terach and all the idols and all that?
Exactly. That's an important thing. And Ryan is writing on screen, I have the same commentary, and it also says, quote, accordingly, the verse's reference to 430 years as the time they dwelled in Egypt means that the Egyptian exile had been decreed 430 years before the Exodus. Well, that's hard, Ryan, because the verse says that the Jews dwelled, the encampment of the Jews was 430 in there, not that when it was decreed. So it's a difficult thing.
So this would almost suggest that the 430 is spanning the time from when Abraham broke out of idolatry till the slaves are broken out of Egypt.
Right. Now, it's an important piece of information that the Sforno gives us in terms of the question, why were they in servitude? Why did the Jews deserve bondage? So he quotes Ezekiel and chapter 20, verse 8. And there it alludes to the fact that the Jews did not abandon idolatry. Somebody told me yesterday, one of my friends, that Rabbi Chait had said that as the Sforno, that the Jews' sin was idolatry. And that's why they went into bondage. As a first big step towards understanding what's going on. And like you're saying too, which is important, though, that the fact that God told Abraham to leave from Ur Kasdim was... this was connected with idolatry. All right. It says in the beginning.
I have some problems.
What's that?
I have some problems, though.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, in 1240, it says the habitation of the children of Israel. Now, if we go backwards from the Exodus, we're clear back here to Abraham. But Israel hasn't even been born yet.
Right, that's a very big problem.
So we can't... I was starting to say, okay, let's go back to when Abraham left Ur Kasdim, and that's like a breakout of idolatry and so on and so forth, except that there are no children of Israel at that point.
Right. So if there's no children of Israel at that point, how could you talk about that for 430 years the children of Israel they encamped? I mean, historically it's not true and it didn't exist 430 years ago. You're strengthening the question. There's not even an Israelite people to talk about. Abraham was childless 430 years ago. Exactly.
Suppose say that when we talk about the children of Israel, we could talk about them and their predecessors, Abraham being clearly the first. And the moment that he came out of Ur Kasdim was like the major turning point. when he turned away from idolatry and so it seems like there's some connection between the children of Israel getting out from under idolatry.
Right.
It seems to have culminated in its fullness at the exodus from Egypt.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking along the same way. And I can't say I can give an exact interpretation of how to, you know, this verse 12:40, but I'm going to suggest as you're saying. And that is, and we'll see if hopefully all else, well, the major questions might fall into place. And that is that the verse is attributing the Egyptian bondage to the idolatry which commenced 430 years earlier. The very idolatry which God was forcing Abraham to leave. But nonetheless, that day to 430, that existence of idolatry, that was something which still had lingering effects. And the Jews later on succumbed to that, and they had to go into bondage because of that. So there was really the presence of that Egyptian culture was, you could say, it's as if that the Jews were being oppressed psychologically by the idolatrous pull because that dates back to the year 430. So the verse, very loosely, means it's not that there was an encampment of the Jews. There wasn't. There was no encampment. There was no Jews 430 years ago. But that which contributed to the need for the encampment of the Jews was something which was so significant. So it's talked about in the verse as if the Jews are actually in this physical surrounding, this encampment, for 430 years. So it's equating the presence of a very powerful emotion of idolatry that started 430 years ago, it's equating that to as if the Jews were living in it all that time. And that's what the commentaries state, that their sin was idolatry. And that's why they had to be enslaved. Well, they have to answer, of course, well, how does that work? And how does the splitting of the animals work? But if we could just go from there, this we can now answer the other question. If we say it is the effects of that 430-year-old idolatry, which was present and lingered, so when Abraham asked God, by what merit will they inherit the land? So then God says, very simply, what does the splitting of the animals mean? Why is that the merit by which the Jews will inherit the land? They will get out of Egypt, and they will get the land? What's splitting the animals mean? It's the same thing as the command of the Paschal Lamb to reject idolatry, rejecting animals. That was a very predominant form of idolatry. You go to the Museum of Natural History today, and you go to the Egyptian section, you see the idols that they've unearthed. And so many of them are combinations of humanoid and animal features. Animal played a very big role. Not just in Egypt, but that was something which many cultures had.
Excuse me, are the numbers of the animals significant?
I don't know. I didn't go into that. One of the commentaries spoke about it, but I don't have that in front of me, so I can't really comment. But it does, we're starting to now see a little picture emerge, and some things are now falling into place. And we could also, now this we understand now, the measure for measure, why this is going to be. And that's why Abraham had no further question when he asked, when God said, you're going to have children, and they'll be, numerous. So that he accepted God, because that depends only on God. The fact that they would inherit land, that means that there's some merit. What merit is it? So when God told him, he understood, because Abraham was familiar with the idolatry of the times. He was fighting it for years, right? Decades he was fighting against the idolatry of the Chasdim people and other places. So that's why he left off. He had no further question once God told him, because Abraham asked, what merit will my children inherit the land? God says, the destroying of the animals. Now he understood, and so he didn't ask any further. Okay. Now, we also asked, why was it midstream? God, in the beginning of chapter 15, it just says that after these matters, God, the word of God came to Abraham and started speaking to him and telling him his reward is great and so on and so forth. He doesn't identify himself as the God who took him out of Egypt until 15:7, where he talks about giving the land as an inheritance. Now he says, I am the God who took you out of the flames, the furnace of Chasdim. Why is it here that it's appropriate that God says that I'm the one that took you out of the flames of Chasdim? Because that was the whole purpose. Since Abraham, on his own, he had served idols when he was younger, as Maimonides says, but then his mind started to ponder, and he started to think over, and he started to realize. And by the age of 40, he had recognized his creator. So he was, for decades, thinking into it and rejecting idolatry and arriving at a crystalline image of how the world operates and understanding there must be a creator and all the ramifications as far as a human can. And because of that, God was going to take him out and to make him into a nation. So that's why God now identifies himself here as I'm the one that took you out of Ur Chasdim, because this is the reason I took you out, is because since you became this great person and you're teaching people, I'm going to isolate you in your own land. So he associates the giving of the land with the purpose of why he took the objective of why he took Abraham out of Chasdim. That's why he says in the middle, he says, I'm the God who took you out of Ur Chasdim. Meaning you have to read between the lines. That was for the sole purpose of the fact that Abraham would now teach his descendants about the falsehoods of idolatry. And then he says to give you the land as an inheritance, because this is what you need in order to incubate your ideas and to raise a nation that could be a beacon to the rest of the world. Right. Now, let's ask the other main question. We had, since they were involved, the Jews didn't succumb to idolatry. How does slavery resolve that issue? And God says to Abraham what exactly? He says in verse, it's 15:13, and God said to Abram, you should certainly know that a stranger will be your seed and land not to them. That's significant. The Avodim, they'll enslave them. The Enosim, and they'll afflict them for 400 years. Why is that the correct response?
Is it because during that time when you are downtrodden, if you have idolatrous tendencies, that you would tend to try to call on those idols and would realize after a while that they're nothing and eventually bring yourself back to an understanding of,
well, how does that work?
Real God is.
How does servitude do that?
Well, because you become desperate and you start crying out for help. If you cry out to help for to the idols and nothing happens. I'm not even satisfied with this idea as I'm speaking it, but I'm just thinking out loud.
Right.
Is it because in servitude it's a humbling position?
And what would humbling be needed to correct an idolatrous people? How would that work?
Well, it seems like when you make these idols and things, you're almost sort of creating yourself, and then sort of giving them power, which is idolatrous. And a humbling experience recognizes that you're not all powerful.
I don't see that. I don't see what that means, that you're giving.
Well, when you make idols,
yeah.
I mean, these idols come about by themselves. You make them, and then you give them power in the sense of how you relate to them.
Okay. So if you get in servitude, you'll stop praying to the idols. I mean, Rashi says that 4/5 of the Jews perished in the plague of darkness because they didn't abandon idolatry. They, you know, 4/5 of the Jews did not leave. Those 600,000 men above 20. And that's just men, not women. And it's also just men above 20. So it's, you know, you have like 2.5 million people. That's only a fifth of what the actual amount of Jews were in Egypt, according to Rashi.
So, Rabbi, is it because if you're going to serve a false god, you might as well, you'll be punished by serving something that isn't inactive, but something that will actually cause you oppression? I mean, by serving the wrong thing, then you'll get a wrong master, or at least in this case.
Well, what, I'm not sure, how would that correct their idolatrous leaning? So I don't know if I have a complete answer, but just looking at the verse, again, 15, and that's the method we have to use in terms of you know, approaching everything. Well, what's the information that God gave us in the verses? So he said that you should know for surety that your seed will be a stranger in a land not to them, and they will afflict them, they'll put up to servitude, and they'll afflict them for 400 years. So God's pronouncing the point that there was, they're going to be a stranger in a land. That means their identity will be clear, and they will always be a stranger. They will not assimilate. And perhaps some element of the fact of being forced into a situation where they were not able to assimilate, maybe that's what was needed. Perhaps they would have assimilated had they not entered Egypt. And it would have been just a loss of any type of cohesive, identifiable group of the children of Jacob. So being in a state where they were strangers in a land that is not to them isolates them. Rabbi Fox spoke about this. And the affliction and the pain could be, as you were saying, they would cry out. There would be a need to abandon where they are. It would leave some sort of a negative taste in their mouth, despite the fact that a lot of the Jews, most of them, had succumbed to idolatry. And again, I'm just bringing this as a suggestion. I'm not saying conclusively, but the verse does point it out that this was a necessary state of affairs. God is telling Abraham what is some primary features of God's response to the fact that the Jews were succumbing to idolatry.
As an aside, are we assuming that what is happening here is that God is foreseeing what they will choose from their own free will?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Okay.
Now, why is God telling this to Abraham? He doesn't tell, we asked the question, he didn't tell Adam, he didn't tell Noah. I'm wondering if there's something significant of the fact that he tells Abraham. I know it's getting a little late here, you have the class coming up, but is it because with this knowledge, he can take action? I was just wondering if that was, somebody else wanted to say, it's just he's now the leader of the nation, and God wanted to inform him of what future events would happen. So by right, you know, that he worked to pronounce monotheism in the world. So God is now telling him what the outcome, you know, will be. And it could be very true. I have no problem with that. But perhaps giving this knowledge, Abraham could do what he can in order to ensure that at least the best possibility for his, you know, knowing that there's going to be this tendency towards idolatry and the need for correction. Had he not done anything, had he not known about this forecast, it could be the Jews would have been worse off, maybe unsalvageable. So maybe God gives him certain information. Like, for example, God tells Moses on Mount Sinai, he was up in the mountain. He didn't know about the fact that the Jews had sinned with the calf until God tells him. And then God, after he tells them that they sin, God says to Moses, now leave me, and I'll destroy them. So the rabbis pick up on that, and they say, oh, you see, God is giving a hint to Moses. If you leave me, I'll destroy them. Oh, but if you don't leave me, and you stand here, and you start praying for the Jews, then they have a chance of salvation. You could raise yourself to a higher level, Moses, and you could, through prayer, you raise yourself, perfect yourself to a point, think into the matter, and now you can raise yourself to a level where you could now help remedy the sin of those Jews. But that's only if you stand here with me. So God will give a clue to the intelligent person, and perhaps that's what God is doing here as well. He's giving information. I'm wondering if what Jim was asking, why there was a terrible dread that fell upon him, is because it wasn't good information. It wasn't good news. He now recognized that there was certain darkness in the future of his seed. So that's why there was a fear when God came to this part of the prophecy. Up to this part of the prophecy, there was no fear. So that could answer your question. But the broad strokes, I mean, again, the... let me see if we address at least the main why the demanded servitude we talked about, why he told the future to Abraham, we just said, the fact that he's also going to judge the nation that enslaves the Jews, also meaning that because the Jews themselves are being judged for something bad, it's the idolatry. All right, we explained why the splitting of the animals is the merit that answers Abraham's question. He said, how do I know that they'll inherit the land? So God says, split the animals, meaning if they can reject deification, and that was something they had to do right before they left Egypt, was to kill the Paschal lamb. If they could do that, then they'll merit the land. So that's how God has explained to Abraham that the merit by which they'll earn the land as inheritance. And the main question, of course, the 430, they didn't really encamp there, but like Doug had initially intimated, that it's trying to show you that there's some the Torah is trying to show you how strong. It's as if they're camping right in Egypt for those 400 years, meaning the effects of idolatry. That's something which the Torah is equating to an actual physical living, entrenching yourself physically in a culture. It doesn't have to be in Egypt itself. It started hundreds of years earlier, and just the effects of the idolatry was something which was as if the Torah is telling you they were in Egypt all those years. And we see it traces back to 430 because it parallels the very reason that God is telling Abraham to leave Ur Kasdim, because that was a hotbed of idolatry.
But Rabbi, doesn't it seem odd then? I mean, if Abraham's the one that found his way out of all this, to measure the time period of sort of being in the dark to include his life? I mean, he seems like he got it.
So what are you asking? That it should have dated earlier than 430 when he was younger in idolatry himself?
Or it should have dated from someone else who was in idolatry because... I mean, to date it from the point at which he came out of idolatry and say that, you know, all the people will be oppressed and we related to idolatry, that doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense, what again, that the 430 is dating just to...
It doesn't make sense that the 430 would be measured from the date that Abraham came out of idolatry. Because then what's the common theme for those 430 years? We say that the Jews were in idolatry while they were in Egypt, but Abraham wasn't in idolatry.
Well, maybe it is the fact that that's when he emerged as being the icon, meaning the forerunner of the people that would be succumbing to idolatry. He left the idolatry, but even though he left it at that point, maybe dating back to that moment, because two things happened. He now emerged as being the beginning of what the Israelite nation will be, but it's also paralleling the place he left. I mean, there's a significant moment there that, that took place, his leaving, his emerging from a place. So idolatry is sort of like the label that you put on the timeline at that moment in history. It has, idolatry was a prominent element at that moment of Abraham leaving that place. His leaving was synonymous with the nature of the place. So maybe it's used to mark that moment as being an idolatrous, in a significant moment relating to idolatry. I don't know if I can say it better.
Well, and that is the moment when a greater responsibility they would have than, say, you know, Kazdin himself, right? Because those people still are in idolatry, but now that they've rejected idolatry, they have a greater responsibility not to go back into it.
You mean Abraham, now that he rejected it?
Yeah. Abraham and his...
I don't know. I don't know if there's a greater responsibility once you reject something.
So I'm looking at 15:13, which says that God said to Abram, "Know with certainty that your offspring," which that phrase to me would not include him, "shall be aliens in a land not their own, and they will serve them, and they will oppress them for 400 years." So it seems like that would suggest that from the birth of Isaac through the Exodus.
Yeah, I understand. But we're forced to go back to that point of 430, because God says that twice, in 1240 and 1241 in Exodus. There's something significant about that time, that moment, that day. All right, think it over. Let the stew of it. We can definitely bring it up and hash out more, but it was something that we were working on. It just caught my attention, and as we discussed it more yesterday, I thought that we would take it up today, because Rabbi Chait said years ago, you should always learn what you're attracted to, because then your energies will be, you know, you'll have the most success. Because if you're attracted to something mentally, something's intriguing you, definitely don't thwart that and go to something else, because then you're going to be dividing your energies. You're sort of like stifling yourself. So if you're interested in something, do it, study it, and you'll have more energy to be successful in that area. So I was thinking I would do that, you know, and again, I mean, it did fit in with the whole theme of justice anyway. But it is just an amazing, you know, piece. I never really went into this area before, but again, it was thanks to my friend, you know, Rabbi Har, Avi Har, who had the question, so it stayed in my mind, and I went through it more and more. So I'll share it with him, and he said he has some ideas too, so maybe I'll speak to him, and, you know, next week we can have more to discuss. All right, any other questions?
Good for now.
Okay, so I wish you a very good week. We'll pick up next Sunday, same time.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, good week to everybody.
You have a good week, too.
Thank you.
The class was very intriguing, Rabbi.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good week, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.